This is NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project. Today is July 9th, 2015, and tonight we're going to be talking about the U Media Learning Labs Network. I'm your host. My name is Kay Fye Steele, and I'm at the National Writing Project in Berkeley, California. So I thought that tonight we could introduce everyone basically to the U Media Learning Labs Network, and I wanted to talk about it first kind of at like the bigger level, what we do, what the network is all about, but then I really wanted to give folks a view of what a day in the life looks like at these three sites, and I think you can really get a clear understanding of what U Media is through looking at a few different examples and different iterations of it. So tonight we're pleased to have several guests to talk with us, and we have Marika Stalock from the St. Paul Public Library, Matt Baker from the Science Museum of Virginia, and Jennifer Berardino from the Museum of Fine Arts Houston. So thanks, everyone, for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So I thought I would just take a few minutes and just explain what U Media is, but I also just wanted to give a sense of some general ideas, but then I wanted to move quickly into talking to all of these folks because they're really the exciting part of this. So this started with a grant from IMLS, the Institute for Museum and Library Services, and the MacArthur Foundation. And most of these sites began around 2011. It was a grant for 24 learning labs in libraries and museums, and it was a planning grant. It wasn't any implementation money. It was all about planning. So if you were to build a teen space in your library or museum, what would it look like, and what would that educational space look like, and what would the educational goals be in that space? So these 24 learning labs, but before that, in 2009, 2008, there were three early adopter sites that were funded by MacArthur, and those sites were U Media Chicago at the Chicago Public Library, which you might have heard of, Art Lab Plus at the Hirshhorn in D.C., and Dream Yard in the Bronx in New York. So many of these sites have grown over time. Many of the sites are in very different spaces. If you just look at our roster today, Science Museum of Virginia, Museum of Fine Arts Houston, St. Paul Public Library, totally different geographic areas, totally different learning environments, institutions, but they all have very much unifying elements, and that's what I'm really excited to talk about today. So just to go over what some of those elements are, because you may have heard of them through National Writing Project work, this concept of connected learning. So that's a learning framework that really puts youth at the center of their educational ecosystem. And it works really well when you think of out-of-school learning and how it connects to in-school learning, and basically says that learning can happen at any time and in any sort of situation. So it also says that, you know, for a teen or for a youth or for any sort of learner, the way that you're going to learn best is if you're following something that you're interested in, whether that's like biology or science or English. If you find your own interest, you're going to be more likely to participate. It's also peer supported, meaning that if you have a network of people around you, or if you have friends that are engaging in the same activity, you're going to be more likely to participate. And it's also academically or future oriented, so you have some sort of goal with whatever it is that you're engaging in. There's also this term that you'll hear probably a lot in this conversation called HIMAGO, and that stands for, so it's an anagram, it stands for hanging out, messing around, and geeking out. So in these spaces, there are different levels of participation that a youth could take throughout the course of an hour, where they're just go from watching some kids making things to doing a deep dive to just dabbling a little bit. And the other thing that the U Media Network really is interested in is this notion of production over consumption. So libraries and museums are typically places where you go and you consume material, or there's very much a one-way street between the educator in the space and the patron or like the museum visitor. And it's this museum visitor, this patron, is this empty vessel that's to be filled up with information. And the U Media Network kind of flips that idea on its head and is all about, well, you make things, and what are the things that you're going to learn as you're making them? And to help along the way, we've also rethought the staffing model in terms of bringing mentors into the space. So mentors are generally people who are either coming from the art side or the science side and are leading you through this learning in terms of, you know, helping them to find their interest. But it's more of like almost a boys and girls model of that closer to one-on-one support or small group support. So I wanted to turn it over. That's like kind of your U Media crash course, but what does this actually look like in spaces? So let's talk to Marika first. Hi, Marika.
Hi.
So I wanted to ask you a couple of things about your space, Createch. It's in the St. Paul Public Library. And I was wondering if you could talk about the way that your institution has changed as a result of having developed the space.
Absolutely. When we started with this IMLS grant, I think we came in thinking that we were going to be needing to lure a bunch of kids into libraries using technology. And, you know, my biggest concern at that time was, are we going to build a space that a bunch of teenagers are not going to want to come into? Like, how are we going to lure them in with all this technology? How do we get them into the library? And then the first time we met as a cohort, I remember hearing that it wasn't all about the technology, that it was about the mentorship. And it was all of us really transformed kind of how we were thinking about what we were going to do. It wasn't about getting a bunch of technology for the kids. It was about creating spaces with mentors in them where the kids would feel welcomed. And that is just a very different model than libraries, at least in St. Paul, had been operating in the past. We often looked at how we would do teen programming as like trying to figure out an event that we could put on that teens would come in and participate. So this has really changed how we've done things in St. Paul Public Libraries, as opposed to having huge programs that we spend money on and get, you know, a fair attendance at. We started creating spaces for our teens and really putting most of our money and time and resources into those spaces and making sure that teens feel like they have an ongoing place that they can hang out. And then it's been really bringing that youth work culture into what we've been doing. So now we have library staff who are consider themselves youth workers, and that was not the case before we had the grant. So one of the things that we really relied on was when we learned about Hamago, so the hanging out, messing around, and geeking out, that really helped us kind of explain to the library staff the importance of hanging out, because I think in the past when teens were just hanging out and not doing something, they were considered like, you know, being kind of a nuisance. Like they're just sitting there, they're not reading, they're not like engaged in anything. And so when we started using this Hamago model to say, you know, kids need to feel comfortable coming into a space and hanging out, like that needs to be an okay thing for us to embrace. It really changed kind of how I think we started providing programming across the board, and it's really trickled into other programming that we've been offering for both adults and for younger kids as well, but it really started with the teens.
That's great. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So one thing that I wanted to ask you too is, can you describe the partnership that's happened, or just briefly like the partnership
Absolutely.
Between you and the Parks and Rec, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so we were the only site that had a partnership with Parks and Rec, which is a very unusual, I think. We've had people from Parks and Rec sites around saying, what is this partnership about? It's a very cool way for us to actually get a bunch of kids that don't normally come into libraries. We're getting, the partnership started off where we were going to be co-create, we knew we were building a space together. There's a new build for us and a new build for the Parks and Rec in a community that it's one of our it's the lowest income community in St. Paul, and it was really lacking resources for our youth. And so we built this wonderful facility that has a full-size gym, it has a walking track and a fitness center, and then also has our full library And then on the lower level by the gym is the Createch studio. And so it's a dedicated space. It's only for teens, and it's been just wildly successful because we're getting kids that are the library kids, but we're also getting kids that are the Parks and Rec kids, the ones that hang out and, you know, play basketball all winter and play soccer all summer, and we're not coming into the libraries. And now, you know, when they need to take a break from basketball, they're coming into our space and they're getting engaged in, you know, movie making, or we've got a recording studio now. And so they're starting to get really engaged in that. So that's been a really wonderful outcome, that partnership with Parks and Rec.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah,
we also
have a partnership with the Science Museum, with Science Museum of Minnesota brings over their Teen Tech Crew, which is another great partnership. We've got teens that provide some of the programs in the spaces now. And we also have the St. Paul Neighborhood Network, and they provide programs around their cable TV station, and they provide video, you know, media making workshops for our teens as well. So we are trying to connect with as many you know, resources that are already happening in the area, and just trying to kind of funnel them all and not doing siloed programming anymore.
Right. And you're a great model of partnerships and collaboration. I just think that's fantastic. I think a lot of libraries feel like they need to do it all and make it all themselves. So it's very smart and very strategic what you're doing. So I wanted to ask, what has been a really rewarding thing for you professionally by being part of the building of Createch and making all these partnerships? And
this has just been an amazing thing to watch unfold. I've been watching it spread throughout the whole St. Paul Public Library system and to our partner site too. Just kind of thinking about we just keep keeping the teens in the center of what we're doing, and it's not all about libraries. We're lucky enough to have a director, Kit Hadley, is our director of libraries, who said, you know, the importance of, you know, St. Paul Public Library is not to serve St. Paul Public Library, it's to serve all of St. Paul, which is a lovely model. So we are able to go out and do our programs, and she doesn't really care if it's happening in our brick-and-mortar spaces as long as it's happening for the kids of St. Paul. And so I'm seeing this idea of, like, the youth work model, the Imago, and the mentor model really spreading to how we're doing programs for our younger kids. We now have maker camps for our 8 through 12-year-olds, and we've got maker fests that are for adults and families, I mean, for anyone. And so I'm just seeing it spread, you know, way beyond the teen program that we originally thought this was going to be for. So that's been really powerful.
That's wonderful. And I also wanted to ask you how you think Createch differs from other learning labs, or how it differs maybe from other library branches within the St. Paul Public Library system.
Yeah, so our Createch studio, the one big main space, we've got a couple other satellite sites. We've got four other sites that do it just once a week. But our Createch studio is located in the neighborhood that's struggling the most economically, and so we're able to reach kids that are really don't have access, probably, I mean, a lot of them, to just even Wi-Fi or a computer at home. So we are able to provide just some basic, you know, skill, 21st century technology for teens to just kind of get their homework done if needed, or to go that extra, you know, if they wanted to make a movie for homework, they could do that in our space, as opposed to, you know, the kids that are in our more affluent neighborhoods where they might have a parent that has a video camera, or they have, you know, some of those other you know, the equipment at home. So that's been really, I think, one of the things that I see striking when I'm talking to other learning websites and even our other library branches, is that we're dealing with, you know, some really real issues with access to technology, and it's really great to see that the access is getting to the kids that really kind of need it.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing that I love about the network and that really seems to unite the network is this commitment to digital inclusion and providing access. So not only the access to things like the tools and technology, but also I feel like it's not just about access to tools, but it's certainly about access to knowledge. You know, just because you have access to a computer doesn't mean that you necessarily know how to use Google or how to use be able to look up. Yeah, and you know, I think we really take some of those things for granted, and we have this assumption that anyone under the age of 18 is a digital native and they know how to use technology, and we really overlook the fact that, you know, everyone can be learning all of the time.
Yes. I totally agree. I think one of the greatest things that I've been seeing come out of it too is that they're building that trust of a mentorship in the space, so that if they do come in and they just needed to use a video camera for something, then they might stick around and play video games for a while, and then by doing that, they're going to also then see the Science Museum kids come in, and they start getting connected to other adults doing other things, and that mentorship of having the same staff in the space over and over again, that they get to know their names and get to know what's going on in their lives outside of the space, that's just been transformative on how we're able to deliver service to the kids.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Also think that I think your partnerships sound like they're really supporting this notion of Hamago in the space too. I love your description of kids coming in and playing basketball, and when they get bored of that, they go into the studio, and when they get bored of that, they can move. I think this mm-hmm. idea also of having multiple things to do within a space is also very contra to typically what libraries do, which is plan a program. This is the program that we're doing in the space at this time.
Yep, that's so true. So yes, now it's like, yeah, you don't want to be in there. Okay, there's several other options. You can go into this quiet, you know, they can go up to the library proper if they wanted to have a quiet space to work on their homework, and then they can come down and play video games, and they can go play basketball in the next area. So it's really nice to have that dynamic space.
Great. Thank you so much, Marika.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I would like to now introduce Matt Baker at the Science Museum of Virginia. Hi, Matt.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. So I would like to ask you a little bit about your space. And I was wondering if you could also tell us what your space was like for teens before your grant started.
So we didn't really have a space for teens before this grant started. Our teen programs pretty much consisted of our volunteer and internship programs. And the physical space that became the mix was actually a storage and custodial closet for many years when I first started here at the museum. It then became a slightly more used kind of boardroom style room with a long boardroom type of table and a little bit of video and kind of digital equipment for making presentations. And a portion of the room was kind of like a workspace, but really wasn't getting used that much, wasn't that welcoming. So with this grant, we really kind of took a look at that space and used that as our new space for our teens. So we are able to set it up to, you know, change some of the colors, to bring in some new kind of more inviting, you know, more teenager-friendly furniture, I guess, and, you know, really make the space more welcoming and get more use out of it. So it's changed tremendously since its, you know, original conception for the space. So.
Right. I mean, yeah, it sounds like, and you're not the first person, and you're not the first site that I've heard of where you identified a space or a room within your institution that was really underused, and you were able to, I'm guessing, can you talk about that process of, how were you able to get access to the space, or was it something that you went through executive staff to get access to?
Yeah, there wasn't, you know, I didn't really have to fight for it too heavily. I think, you know, the administrators here at the museum saw that the space wasn't being used very much. And when this grant came about and, you know, we knew we were a part of the second cohort, it was kind of just the natural progression for the space, I think. It had some really nice windows on the side, so we're kind of in a fishbowl, but that's cool because that gives us some good exposure to the rest of the museum guests. So I think, you know, being so visible, even though we're kind of down in the basement and a little bit hidden, having those windows, it was just kind of, it just felt natural to use this space for that. So I really didn't have to do much convincing. You know, when it came to some of the furniture choices, that took a little bit more convincing. But yeah, it was a pretty easy process to get that going.
Yeah, I have a feeling too. That's another thing that I've also heard, like so many emails about what exact kind of chair to get and what exact kind of table and table height. It's kind of crazy once you get in the weeds of like planning a space like that. So I wanted to ask you, what has been a really rewarding thing for you personally, professionally, being part of the creation of the space and now the management of the space?
I think, you know, as an ex-classroom teacher, it's been really cool to see this creativity and collaboration and problem-solving and critical thinking really taking shape with the teens kind of at the helm. You know, that's something that I think, you know, I know as a classroom teacher, and I think other classroom teachers face, it's kind of hard to implement some of the critical thinking, more fun, enriching activities within a classroom setting. And this type of space has really allowed me to see that come to fruition and really just be able to sit back and let them go to it and not really even have to force it on them because they know, the teens know that that's part of it. We started with a teen advisory council, and you know, that was kind of our initial planning stage where I had 10 to 12 teens, depending on the meeting, show up, and we would talk about, again, furniture that they wanted to see. We would talk about designing a membership card, and they actually went through InDesign and kind of designed their card using Adobe InDesign. And, you know, so we talked about programming they wanted to see. So from the very beginning, it was obvious that they had a lot of input and a lot of things to say that maybe hadn't been heard in the past. So it was really nice to give them that venue to really share what they wanted to learn, how they wanted to learn it, and go about it. So that's been the best thing. And to see them just down there, I was just down there, you know, before we started this program, and they're working on robots and they're talking, and just, you know, to kind of echo what Marika was saying, you know, you get to see this banter between them and the mentors and these relationships start to develop, and it's, you know, it's really great. Honestly, it does my heart good to see that. So, you know, because some of us are, you know, can be like, oh, kids these days, but there's a lot of good in our kids these days, and that's helped me see this.
That's great, and it's really interesting to hear your perspective of this coming from a classroom and in a classroom setting. And I mean, it's really moving from one institution to another in a way, but it sounds like what you're saying, especially with the Teen Advisory Council, that it sounds like what you've noticed is that teens have been given a voice, essentially.
Right.
And it,
right.
Yeah, it, go ahead.
And I think that's, you know, I think that's something they lack in a lot of aspects of their life, you know, school included. So to have this space to really feel like they own it and, you know, it's of their own design is pretty cool, I think.
Right. And having this notion of having a teen advisory council was something that all sites did of the 24 learning labs. And I'll ask some of the other people maybe towards the end to talk about their teen advisory boards, because I think this is something I didn't mention. It's a really crucial part of the way that these sites work by themselves and with each other, this notion of participatory design and having youth be really central agents in determining what goes on in the space and how the space is run, how the space is designed, and how the space is, I don't want to use the word governed, but how the site operates.
Right.
So speaking about like institutions, actually, you know, I'd like to talk about workshops, because I feel like we touched on institutions a bit, and I know that you've run some really fantastic programs at the Mix. Can you talk about maybe a couple of your favorites?
Sure. One that I really liked. So we started our model with much more of the hanging out and the messing around portion of Homago, and then would occasionally have the geeking out, which we kind of consider our workshops to be that geeking out portion of that. They can geek out on their own time too, definitely, but we kind of have a little bit more guided geeking out in our workshops. One of them that I really enjoyed and I think we had a huge turnout for too was our zombie detection device workshop. So it was just kind of a fun way to couch embeddable electronics and wearable electronics. So we used Flora microcontrollers, and we used some light sensors that are compatible with those, some LED kind of pixels and conductive thread to have the students create their own wearable zombie detection devices. So that came out in many different shapes and forms. Some of them made little zombie detection kind of bracelets or cuffs. Some of them made zombie detection vests that they would wear over their full body. But essentially these devices that they made, they would then, after they were done and coded and their design was, at least their prototype design was done, they would then walk around the science museum. And what these devices actually did, obviously there are no zombies, but what they did was they would kind of read light levels in different areas of the museum. And the code that they put in using the Arduino IDE would tell the device, it's high light levels, medium light levels, low light levels. And then the color of their LEDs would change depending on the light level of the room. So in a really dark area of the museum, where the zombies are most apt to be hanging out, they would get this red pixel. Or if it's a high light area in the museum, it would be green. And, that would mean that they're totally safe from the zombies. And so we had them go around the museum and actually take a museum map with them and map out the quote-unquote zombie zones within the museum. That was a lot of fun. Anytime you can bring in zombies, I think people enjoy it. Mm-hmm. Most people. Zombies aren't for everybody, but they all had a really good time with that, and it kind of led up to a further challenge that we did a couple of weeks later with having them create kind of emergency preparedness plans in the event of a zombie apocalypse or, some major emergency. So we try to tie our workshops into kind of a monthly challenge, and that was loosely tied to our monthly challenge that way.
That sounds great. And, the other thing that I love about that is there are so many different entry points to that theme. And, I mean, there's a possibility for, storytelling and writing on top of that, and crafting and sewing and programming. I love that it all got sort of mixed in this workshop.
Yeah, and that was kind of the idea behind it. And that's the great thing is because we have so many different types of members in our space, some of them are really into the electronics and the coding, so they would do that aspect. Some of them were really into kind of, like you said, the crafting and the sewing, and they would kind of take on that portion of the project. So, you might not have had everybody learning every skill necessarily, but you had a lot of great teamwork and collaboration going on to complete that one zombie detection device. And then, of course, they would go around in teams actually mapping the zombie zones. So.
Right. That's great. So what are the most popular workshops? What are the most popular tools and materials that get used in the mix?
Well, right now we've been doing 2 weeks of robot building. So since June 22nd and through the end of this week, we've kind of been doing project-based learning based on robots and creating our own robots. So I would have to say, again, the Hummingbird robotics kits are a huge fan favorite. The Finches, we have a couple of Finch robots, and these all come from Bird Brain Robotics. I think they're out of Pittsburgh, if I'm not mistaken. Tetrix robotics kits. We have a lot of kids who are into the robots and the design and programming of those robots. Of course, Snap and Scratch for programming languages. We get those used quite often, whether to program a robot or maybe just to create their own video game or maybe, in conjunction with Makey Makeys, which are another hot item. because they're kind of such a low entry point with a makey-makey that anybody can just jump right in. But then you can also get into the code and change it using the Arduino language if you want to and kind of reprogram your makey-makeys. We have a few 3D printers in the space, and those are a big pull, and we find those getting used quite a bit, but they also just gain interest from everybody who's walking by the window and sees one. They're like, oh, what is this space? We want to come in. So, you know, we really encourage our teens to not just print things off of, that they find off of Thingiverse, but to actually create their own 3D designs. So, you know, through just having those printers available and kind of in everybody's face, we've started using Tinkercad, 123D Design, and SketchUp a lot more. And then to go back to that, you know, that point of kind of digital equity, we tend to use as many free programs as we can so that the teens can then, you know, go home and get SketchUp on one of their devices at home so they don't have to, you know, purchase some expensive AutoCAD program or, you know, Photoshop for photo editing. We tend to use GIMP for that. So we really try to use whatever free software we can, and then they come in and use kind of our 3D printers to print it out, or our robots to make their Scratch or Snap program come to life.
That's great. That's another thing I would just like to highlight, because I think that's wonderful, is this notion of identifying and using open source software. So there are so many open source alternatives to things like Photoshop or InDesign or Illustrator, things that cost a lot of money. And I think it's great to be able to introduce kids to this idea of open source hardware software, in terms of like it exists out there, and there's a whole community of people who make and share things for free. And
yep.
It's also just like wonderful to be able to have it in your space for you as an educator. If you don't have the money to buy a subscription to Creative Cloud, to be able to have these alternatives and be able to use them and teach them, I think it's really wonderful to be able to do that.
I agree.
Yeah. So one last question for you. I wanted to see what you thought of about the way that your space is different from the other UMedia learning labs in the network.
Yeah, I think one of the differences is that, you know, being a science museum, and like I said, not really having much of a teen audience for, you know, probably the last decade or so, you know, we really had to kind of message the fact that, hey, there's a place for you to come hang out, a safe spot for you to hang out or mess around with equipment or work on a project from school with our mm-hmm. cameras and green screen or, you know, our software or our 3D printers or whatever the case may be. So, you know, kind of messaging was a initial issue, and I think that we definitely did not have the kind of drop-in population that I think libraries are going to tend to have more than. So, you know, we've kind of had to figure out how to get the teens involved, and now that the word has spread, and honestly, word of mouth has been our best marketing tool. Once the teens realize they like the space, they tell their friends, and then, you know, we go from having 5 people in there to 10 people to 15. So, you know, that was a big difference, I think, and because of that, we came up with a membership for these teens. I know there are other sites that do similar kind of membership things, so we're not alone in that. But we really wanted them to have their own personal membership card so they felt like they really belonged to the space, that it was their space. And also so that when they go to the front desk of the museum, they can just swipe their card. They don't have to pay the museum's admission fee every time they come to the mix. So they get this free membership that essentially acts as a museum membership as well, but also allows them to come down to the mix and hang out with us. So I think, you know, that kind of initially setting up that up was kind of a challenge, but I think that makes us a little bit different than some of the other spaces. You know, we don't really have that kind of front-facing facade where they can just walk in the front door, hang out for a second, and leave. They have to come find us in the basement. So we have to figure a way around that kind of. So I think that's probably the only major difference. Other than that, I think we're, you know, all the tenets and, you know, the things you've talked about with connected learning and Homago and having it, you know, teen interest-driven, I think that fits in with all the other spaces.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the museums struggled more with this notion of drop-in or, you know, this like low barrier to entry thing because museums, you know, typically charge some sort of admission fee. And how are you going to get teens, particularly the ones that are in like low-income neighborhoods, who might not, especially in cities where public transportation is neither easy nor particularly accessible, how are you going to get those teens in your space? The other thing that I know a lot of museums talked about was museums tend to only have one location versus libraries that have branches that are in the community. So that seemed to be another obstacle for getting teens. And so kudos to you guys for figuring out ways to get around that and addressing that issue directly.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I mean, transportation is still an issue. There are definitely some areas of Richmond that I would like to pull more heavily from. But like you said, some, you know, the transportation infrastructure is just not set up. So, you know, we're kind of looking forward and maybe going to examine, you know, some ways to offer bus passes or something of that nature as well.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks, Matt.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So I'd like to now bring on Jennifer Berardino from the Museum of Fine Arts Houston. Hi, Jen.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. So I'd like to hear a little bit about your space as well, especially this whole idea of U-Media Learning Labs within an art museum. So could you talk just a little bit about the space and sort of the way that it's situated within your space?
Yeah, absolutely. So our teen group is called HANG at MFAH, and that's an anagram for Houston Art New Generation. So I'll just refer to HANG throughout the conversation
sure.
to keep it short. But it's really interesting. So we're in an encyclopedic art museum, and we operate essentially as a mobile learning lab in a shared classroom space. So we have, you know, sort of constructed all of our tools and needs in a really flexible format so that we can roll things in and out of a closet pretty quickly and in and out of a classroom and into galleries if necessary. So I sort of see us as a mobile learning lab, but we use the entire museum as our learning space because I think one of the really unique things about being in an art museum is a lot of our assets are in our galleries. You know, sort of the evidence of making throughout culture and time is sort of situated in our galleries. So it's a really nice conversation point for our group to think about what exactly they're doing and how it plays into this dialogue through time of what is art and what is technology as a medium of the 21st century. So while we don't have a permanent physical space, we do have the permanent physical space of the entire museum, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the way that your institution has changed as a result of developing HANG.
Yeah, so not unlike Marika, I think we had some trepidation of teens just hanging out in our galleries and sort of the unknown of what that might bring to the museum. And not out of a disinterest, I don't think, but I think it was just really the possibility of what does it mean to just spend time at a museum, particularly art museums. We can be a little standoffish sometimes. And I think art museums are really good at providing opportunities for people to geek out. But maybe the future of what art museums really need to be are sort of forging ahead in the path of also hanging out and messing around. And by that, I mean, really museums should be social places, places of social learning and interaction. And so I think there has been a significant shift to see teens in our galleries, in our spaces, working with curators, all on their own, but also during our hours of hang. And so really before this grant, we had very few teens coming to the museum unless they were a part of sort of a scheduled school visit. So they're now choosing to do this on their own time, and it's really beginning to shift the understanding of what we need to be doing for visitors in general, but particularly this audience. And really our hang teens have begun to really take on a leadership position within the institution to help sort of transform it in that way. And it's a slow process, but I will say that it's, you know, it's pretty incredible to see our hang teens kind of walk through the doors and feel very welcomed by our security officers and our membership and guest services department. And they really feel like they own the museum, and they should, because the motto of our museum actually is a place for all people. And so we're really driving that home through involving them, both in programs in the museum, but also really beginning to think through what does it mean to be a 21st century art museum and how can we best do that.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So I'd like for you to tell me about one of the mentors that's in your space.
Yeah, I mean, I think we would all agree that the mentors are almost the most critical component of all of this. And so while we have one key mentor who really leads the charge in terms of thinking through curriculum and conceptualization of opportunities and how this all starts to connect, we also have begun to see our teens as mentors to new members who sort of join up in our group, which is really pretty cool. Our key mentor is a new media artist by practice. So he's really got a critical eye on sort of understanding how technology is a material of the 21st century and what the ramifications of that are, and then how to contextualize that through our galleries. And then he really has cultivated junior mentors through our teen program. So as new teens begin to join us and get to know us a little bit, our teens who have been around quite a while really take on the role of mentoring new folks in feeling comfortable at the museum and sort of understanding what the processes are and what the tools are and starting to explore what their possibilities are. So it's really kind of unfolding over time that we're cultivating not only a really solid mentor at the helm of this, but also kind of allowing our teens to essentially geek out and become mentors of their peers.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that speaks to so many things that we've already talked about, which is really cultivating teen, not only teen involvement and teen voice in the design of the space, but in terms of like leading and guiding the space and opportunities like that. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and I see our group as a really kind of interesting united voice. There's sometimes dissent among of what we should be working on and how we should approach things. But I actually think that's a really powerful moment. As Matt was talking about, really thinking about critical thinking skills and problem-solving skills, I mean, these are true skills of the 21st century, and not to get all jargony, but the reality of working in a group and understanding each other's strengths and negotiating those strengths is a really powerful thing. And we can actually do, I mean, we're teaching that in all of our spaces. We may not always, it may not seem deliberate all the time, but it's happening. And I think that's one of the most interesting things from my point of view about kind of how this is really unfolding in my institution.
That's wonderful. Yeah, and I think that's a really great point that you bring up, this idea that, you know, in the real world, you're never always going to like get an answer to something. You're never going to, there will never be an answer. Typically, like, you'll always have people dissenting, and it's always going to be some sort of compromise. And that's a really powerful
right.
thing to acknowledge, and to acknowledge as an adult with teens.
Yeah, and it's great to sort of be able to stand back and let them sort of work those things out in a really safe and democratic space mm-hmm. where there's not a lot to be lost, right? I mean, we're not a classroom, so we're not giving out grades. We're not, you know, they don't need to necessarily look for approval from any of us. It's really about them sort of understanding how to negotiate those things in a really complex way, and then being able to voice that and articulate it. So it's I don't know, it's kind of a fascinating side of what's happening that I did not expect.
That's really cool. That's great. So I guess I also want to ask you other things that you weren't expecting about, in like the way that your job has changed and your role in the space has changed.
Yeah. I mean, so I was, you know, sort of the project lead on the grant. And I helped conceptualize the grant quite a bit. And so I kind of had a sense of where we were going, but I'm always very open to, we have a little bit of a plan, but we know that we're going to have to remain nimble and flexible and kind of move along as the audience or as the teens are giving us feedback. And, you know, we've evolved pretty drastically over the last 4 years, I guess it's been now. And I don't know that that's surprising, but it certainly has changed my job in the way that museums or art museums tend to sort of offer programs and you kind of wrap it up and move on to the next thing. But because this is a weekly program, we see the same teens over and over. We've had teens in this program 4 years at this point. You know, it requires you to challenge yourself on a pretty consistent basis to kind of keep people interested and engaged and up the ante a little bit, and to work with audiences who are both in the geeking out area as well as hanging out and messing around. That's a pretty serious thing. And so I think what's interesting from my point of view and how it's really begun to change my job is that I'm using this model throughout other program areas. I work a lot with teachers and school curriculum, and so I'm starting to think through how do these ideas of connected learning and Hamago, how can they infiltrate and inform other program areas, which makes it a much more completed cycle, especially when we're talking connected learning and what's happening in and out of school.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So I also wanted to ask you how your space is different from other learning labs.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've briefly talked about this, but I think one of the most unique things, and this is, you know, true of every site, is every site has some unique assets. And so our assets really are our collections, our mentor, and the expertise that's at the museum. And so, I mean, we even see mentors through our curatorial department. Our teens work hand in hand with a handful of curators on programs. They work really closely with our film curator to screen films for other teens and introduce it and do a talk back. And so I think what I think is really unique about us is that we consider our entire museum campus as our learning lab. That, yes, we can, you know, we can roll out the 3D printer just like everybody else. But what we're really interested in is thinking about how what they're doing in that making time is a reflection of what's in our galleries and the critical conversation that they should be having around understanding, making, and creating as a ramification or as a lens to the world in which they're living. So I think that's kind of fascinating and makes us a little bit unique. And I really do believe a lot of that comes from the fact that we've got a new media artist as our mentor. This is, you know, what our teens are often working on in terms of what they're exploring and making in their own time very much reflects the practice of our mentor. And so I think that adds a really unique perspective that we can, for instance, we're beginning to sort of think about what we want to do in the fall, and we're really starting to look at code as original object. What does that mean? It's one of the few objects in an art museum that you could actually get your hands on, right? So how does that begin to relate to a 16th century painting? Well, there's some really direct relationships there, and so we can really dive into that because of the uniqueness of our site.
Yeah, and certainly the uniqueness of the ideas that your mentors are bringing.
Absolutely.
I think that's a totally fascinating idea, thinking about especially like digital media, like what does that look like in a museum? And you think about all of this content that's being created on the web, what's it going to look like in like 5 or 10 years? Like how do you sell things? Like animated gifs or dead art, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, what are sort of the ownership rights to that type of work, and what are the conservation issues when dealing with tech-based art? These are all pretty kind of unique things to an art museum, and luckily we've got the assets, meaning, you know, the expertise of the staff and the collection, that we can really dive into those things in a really unique way.
Great. Thanks so much, Jen. So we have about 10 minutes left, and I just wanted to invite maybe any other questions that some of the panelists have for each other, any kind of observations that any of you have made listening to each other talk.
Well, I'm kind of curious. This is Jen. I sort of noticed that the three of us really struggled maybe with starting out with maybe limited or no teen audience at all. And I know sort of how we started to capture teen audience. And Matt, you talked about this also. But Marika, sort of from your perspective, you know, how did you grow this audience?
Yeah, I would love to talk about that, because I think that's a big thing about kind of why Hamago's model really worked for us. And that was because of the fact that we started with the Science Museum before this grant, and had programs that were really awesome that teens were developing and coming in, and they wanted to teach other teens how to do things like circuitry, or they did like experiments with dry ice and really kind of fun hands-on stuff. And we would put that in a meeting room, and then we'd make an announcement over the loudspeaker and say, any teens are welcome to go in and learn about circuitry, and like no one would go in. And the library could be full of teens, and we couldn't get them into, like, the meeting room to do the activity. And I remember walking up to a kid who was, like, on Facebook, and I was like, there's this really great, you know, it's a great program. You should go in there. And he's like, I don't know anything about circuitry. Why would I go in there? I was like, that's a really good point. I was like, okay. I was like, yeah, so we just really did some soul searching. And then it was about the same time that this grant started, and we started kind of exploring the model of, you know, having a persistent space. And I was like, why are we having all these kids sign up for, I mean, on the public libraries, we have kids sign up all the time to use their 1 hour or hour and a half of the of their internet time. And that's their time to be on, to like zone out and be on Facebook and do whatever they want. And it was hard for us to get them to go into other programs. But when we were able to then give them an iPad or a laptop inside a room and call it, you know, and also it's CreateTech, and it has the same mentor that they know that they can be kind of louder in there, and they can sit on a beanbag chair with a laptop as opposed to sitting next to, like, you know, some other public person. They were able to just be themselves in the space. They could listen to music. They didn't have to, you know, I don't know. So it was really in creating that space and that persistence that they were coming over and over again. And then we moved what the Science Museum was doing into that same room. So then instead of saying go and do a circuitry class or go and do like this cool experiment with dry ice, we would just say CreateTech is happening. Do you want to be on the computer without having to get kicked off after an hour? And the teens would go in there like gladly. They were like, sure, I'll go in there. And they'd be on the iPads. And then so the Science Museum would set up a table with a bunch of like cool gadgets or, you know, stuff. And they didn't even have to ask the kids. Like, they were curious. And then they're like, oh, what is that? How did you do that? And they'd start playing around with it. And they're like, this is a great model. This is what they were talking about. This is the hanging out and then messing around. Like, it happens so organically and so naturally that you just needed to create the space for the kids to come in and be themselves and not force them to go somewhere different, or not force them to put something on their calendar and remember to come back on, you know, April 24th. We've got an event at 5:00. They didn't want to operate that way. They wanted to just be able to come in and know that, like, every Tuesday at the Rondo Library, they were going to have something to do. So that, it just transformed how we did all teen programming. We stopped. We don't do any programming that's like one-off anymore at all for the whole library.
That's great. So, yeah, and that's very much what libraries do, and I think that's very much what museums do also. And I think that also is, you know, it's it brings up a lot of questions in terms of like what you think they can do also. Like, I think about, like, you know, what kind of language we use with teens, like when you approach a group of teens and we're talking about like access and talking about trying to get like youth that have never done a robotics workshop or who have or might be interested in coding, when you say to them, have you done a robotics class before, versus have you ever played with electricity and electronics and wire before, have you ever seen anyone doing that, you know, it's very much like, you know, if robotics tends to be something that is accessed by kids in wealthier communities.
Absolutely.
But, you know, if you don't have access to those tools, you know, you don't want kids to make you don't want them to feel like they're being more othered, or that it's just a repeat of these are these tools that you don't have access to, as opposed to like, this is just us hanging out and, hey, do you want to look at this thing, or I'm working on this, do you want to check it out?
Yeah,
I think, you know, this is Matt, sorry if I jump in. I think, you know, Marika speaks to a good point too, and K-Fi, you're kind of saying it too. I think that, you know, we've been trying to kind of change the culture of our institutions, but we also are changing the culture of the way our teens think about their own education too. You know, they don't necessarily at school have the ability, like Marika was saying, to just mess around with something, and, you know, they get assessed immediately at school, and if they mess up, there's this sense of failure, and, you know, they don't have the time or the ability to redo it. They just get poor grade, and we're trying to get this cultural shift across to them too, that, hey, it's okay to come in and just mess around and iterate, and failure's all right, and that's how we learn. And, you know, there's some resistance to that at first, as you guys were saying, and once you kind of get them over that initial resistance to, oh, I don't know how to build a robot, or I don't know how to program something with an Arduino, they see that, you know, it's doable, and that all you have to do is just kind of sit down and try and mess up and fail and try again and repeat.
So, I'm so glad you brought that up. This is Marika again. I'm so glad you brought that up, Matt, because I think I'm witnessing that resistance to failure. So it's so hard, especially, I feel like especially in kids that are failing in school, and they come in and they do not want one more thing that they're going to fail at. And so they just put, you know, they'll put it down and walk away, and you're like, wait, but it's okay that you failed. Like, that's a good thing. And you're right, we have to change that culture of what it means to learn.
Yeah, I was just going to sort of chime in and say, you know, we talk a lot with the Hang teens about failing intelligently, that we actually really encourage them to fail, but to understand why whatever it is that they tried didn't work the first time, so that they can go back and iterate it on it and make an improvement. So it is really sort of shifting that understanding that failing intelligently is actually what we're gearing. We're aiming to that.
I mean, ultimately, I see almost the process being more important than the final product that they come up with, whether it's a piece of artwork or a robot or whatever it is they're making.
Yeah.
It's getting that process into their head and making them see that it's okay to mess up, and, you know, really working on that critical thinking and exploration and creativity.
Yeah, and to your point, Matt, I think that as practitioners, we run into problems when all of a sudden we see that we are forcing the kid to finish their product, whatever they're making, for the sake of finishing. And when you're focusing on, oh, let's just get this thing done, or let's just make this work, I think it goes beyond the youth learning, and it's more about getting the thing done. And I wonder if what would happen. I wonder what would happen if we focused instead more on, like, just making the youth understand what they were doing and have it be more about the process. So thank you so much, everybody, for participating in this. I feel like we could keep on talking, but our hour is up, and this always happens. I wanted to point everyone to our community site. It's community.umedia.org to learn more about the community, to ask questions, and to find a lot of these resources that Marika, Matt, and Jennifer have talked about. So that's a wonderful website to look at. Any parting words?
No, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, love this opportunity for us all to talk. And I will be talking to you guys all soon.
Sounds great. Right. Thanks, Kate. Bye.
Thanks so much.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.